Okay, well, I'm not quite sure what dynamic range the audience has, but I'm an observer, and I'm going to tell you basically the direction in which I'm going in terms of constraining galaxy evolution and galaxy formation. And this is work that began at Cambridge with my Cambridge students, and they are moving on to new pastures. Jarle Brinchman was my student, and he's now at Oxford with Joe Silk. Felipe Menantau is finishing, and he's moving to Carnegie Observatories. Mark Sullivan has moved to Caltech with me from Cambridge and is a first-year student. And Bob Abraham, who's a postdoc who's worked with me on a lot of this, is moving to Toronto. So a sort of dispersion of this team. Carl Glazebrook, who's also not mentioned here but has sort of worked with me for a long time, has just arrived at Johns Hopkins and is trying to get his social security number. Okay, so basically the main thing I want to sort of get across is that I think we're moving away from the star formation history to the mass history. I'm talking of observations. I think theoretically the models of galaxy formation have for a long time been well founded in terms of the mass history. We have a clear idea of what we would expect the structure to evolve like, and perhaps one of the triumphs in the last few years has been the merging of that activity with the star formation history. But although I think a lot of progress has been made in that, I want to start by pointing out the limitations. Interesting though those star formation diagnostics are and continue to be in telling us the astrophysics of how galaxies form and evolve, I don't think if we're challenging the models at their fundamentals, I don't think we're going to really get to the end by just star formation histories alone. I'm going to skip this because you all know this. And I'm going to basically make some remarks about why many people already feel that hierarchical assembly is important in galaxy formation from the observational perspective, but I'm going to be fairly critical of the progress that's been made because I think there are many exits. Then we'll move to how to measure galaxy masses, and some of you have heard this aspect before, and then I'll tell you what we're trying to do with the Keck telescope, and maybe a little bit more at the end of that that's not written here. So let's sort of step back and go to how we got to where we are. We began by counting galaxies, so we measured their apparent magnitude distribution. Then we started measuring redshift, so we got their luminosity distribution. Then we started measuring colors, and we got morphologies. And so we really have built up a census, and it's this statistical distribution that the theorists have been trying to reproduce. And one of the triumphs, I think, even though it was incorrect in detail, was the realization that in principle one could attempt to take a single star formation history per unit co-moving volume. So you take a box of the universe, calculate the star formation per unit volume, and then from that star formation, under various assumptions, predict what the luminosity that would emerge from those volumes would be at different look-back times, and attempt then to reconstruct a self-consistent picture. Now, there's an enormous amount of effort in trying to sort of get the details of this right observationally, and fascinating though it is, I don't think, you know, that it's enough. And they've just listed here, I'm sure many of you are familiar with them. There's the various ways in which star formation can be diagnosed. One is the ultraviolet, the other is nebular emission lines, submillimeter radiation from thermally heated dust, chemistry, supernova rates, all various diagnostics. And so let me just say, firstly, that all this is great stuff. We don't yet... it really hides a lot of the astrophysical details that that we would like to know. So let's look at a few examples of this. One is the luminosity function. Of course, when we measure the luminosity density, which is what all of these histories are based on, we integrate over all galaxies in a given redshift slice with a given luminosity. This is a recent luminosity function of galaxies, about 400 galaxies in the ultraviolet, as detected with a balloon flown from a group in Marseille. And the redshifts of all these galaxies have been measured, obviously, and you can see it's an extremely steep luminosity function. And of course, it seems to be a feature of star-forming populations, at least where we've been able to verify their luminosity functions accurately at different redshifts, that luminosity functions like this are often very steep. And so, of course, inevitably, at high redshift, in a statistical survey of the kind that's needed to reconstruct the star formation history from luminosity densities, one has to make fairly substantial corrections for populations fainter than the limit that one can see. And so the uncertainty in that is really quite large. Secondly, in this sort of low redshift range of the luminosity density, one can get rather different interpretations of the same change in luminosity density. So here are two luminosity functions plotted at different redshifts from two different groups. So there's the Canada-France redshift survey group, which shows a low redshift luminosity function, which seems to morphologically change by moving outwards in luminosity when one goes to higher redshift. So a good physical description of the luminosity evolution that one sees in this survey is that the galaxies essentially are in place over this redshift range, but their luminosities are all basically increasing. So one sees a shift in the luminosity as a function of redshift. This redshift survey, the LDSS redshift survey, has comparable numbers in the same redshift range, but was selected slightly differently, but in this plot, I brought them to the same luminosity scale, and you can see that the luminosity evolution is quite different. The bright galaxies don't seem to change very much in their luminosity. Most of the activity is in subluminous objects, which are rather well represented in this survey compared to this survey because of the way in which the apparent magnitudes were arranged. And the main point I want to make is that these two different evolutionary histories, which are coming from these two surveys, are physically very different. Yet their luminosity densities might not be that different. In both cases, obviously, both come from samples where the galaxy counts are steeper than one would be expected, and so consistent with a rise in the luminosity density with redshift. No. And it's depressing that even after measuring all of those redshifts, there's still something going on, you know, that makes them different. And no, I don't think so. I think, well, there's two possible... Well, okay, we could get into why these are not the same. One survey, the Canada-France redshift survey, is a very narrow slice in apparent magnitude. And so at each redshift, you see a portion of the luminosity function. So you try then to reconstruct how that would evolve. This one has a wide range of apparent magnitude. It's not great, very high redshift. And, you know, it's conceivable that the ways in which clustering affects the distributions and so on may have given this result. But I think if Simon Lilly were here, he'd argue that he looked at that and it's not important. I mean, we need much bigger surveys in order to understand the luminosity dependence of changes in the star formation history. So basically, the luminosity densities integrate over important details. Physically, these are very different descriptions of what's happening to galaxy formation, galaxy evolution, and yet they may both give luminosity density changes with redshift. Secondly, if you've been to these conferences where the star formation people are arguing with one another, there's very much a left corner or a right corner approach. That is, you know, that one method is susceptible to dust extinction, the other method is, you know, susceptible to something else. Basically, there is no ideal star formation diagnostic. Not only are star formation diagnostics affected by dust in different ways, depending on their wavelength and the method, but also the timescale over which a star formation diagnostic may be useful depends on the diagnostic. So, for example, in the ultraviolet continuum shown here from this same local redshift survey from Sullivan et al., you're looking at stars with a much longer mean lifetime than those which excite the nebular emission line H-alpha. So when one starts to compare one diagnostic against the other, if galaxies that are active in their star formation have non-constant star formation rates over short periods of time, for instance, if there's a lot of bursting activity driven perhaps by mergers, then one can get different answers, even though for the diagnostics one can get different estimates, even though the actual physics of the for individual objects that are compared, and that's shown in this plot where H alpha was estimated, star formation rate based on H alpha was estimated, as well as the UV for this local survey, with and without extinction corrections. And what we mean by UV corrected is that the extinction implied from H alpha over H beta was applied with the standard law down at 2,000 angstroms, and you notice that regardless of this correction, there is a non-unit slope of this plot. So there seems to be something else going on that we don't yet understand. The other point is it may look as if there's a reasonable correlation, but just to stress, this is a log scale and this is an order of magnitude. So there's a huge amount of scatter, much more than can be reasonably assigned to observational uncertainties in these two diagnostics. The green points here are a very small sample, and this is, I think, one of the areas in which we really need to go with Keck to try to make better estimates of high redshift galaxies for which H-alpha can be measured in the infrared, and the UV obviously can be easily estimated from optical studies. So that was an initial nice piece of work by Glazebrook et al., but the uncertainties were very great because he used an infrared spectrograph on a 4-meter telescope. So it's going to be important to try to understand how these diagnostics compare. So when people say, you know, my method is better than yours, it may not be so simple. Most of the activity has been in estimating the star formation out at high redshift, and since the original plot that I showed you from Pierre Amadou, there's been a sort of evolution in the sense that it's not obvious anymore whether the star formation is declining beyond a redshift of 1. I would argue that even this area here is not yet very well established. And just to emphasize that point, here's a recent compendium of the low redshift end from various methods. And specifically in this very low redshift region here, there's quite a lot of disparity in the different methods depending on how extinction and so forth is applied to the data. So this curve, I mean, if the curve was completely featureless, you know, let's just hypothetically imagine it was, you know, it ends up pretty flat, then one might ask the question, what use would it be? It would tell you that star formation is a continuous process, and you would really like to know what the mass distribution of the objects looks like. Sorry, I'm not. Perhaps I'm overstating the point. What I'm trying to say is that, you know, if you approach this field from the outside over the last few years, you'd think that this curve was really, you know, the key to understanding galaxy formation. And if you wanted to see it from the theoretical perspective, just make this point that, you know, the theorists have evolved as well. And, I suppose that you might say that's good that in 1997, you know, they were close to the data in 1997. For the same cosmological model in 1999, by adding more features, it's closer to the data that we now have. And the reason for that is simply that there is a lot of flexibility in these star formation histories. Okay, so how do we move forward then, and how do we actually test these models? Well, one of the things that struck me a couple of years ago was substantial difference in the way mass has assembled in the hierarchical models compared to the classical models. And although various groups have come up with this idea, I apologize for showing just one of the plots from the Durham group, and that is that in an assembly where merging is occurring over the redshift range 3 right down to 0, you can see quite a strong evolution in the number of massive objects, in this case an object which is thought to end up as an elliptical according to the prescription developed by the Durham group, due to the late merger of two fairly nearly equal mass objects. So this is obviously a scheme that allows semi-analytic people to predict the history of various morphologies. So for example, it allows you to predict the epoch at which the last major merger would lead to an object of present-day elliptical morphology. Now, one can argue about whether this is close to reality or not. The most significant thing is that, depending on the cosmological model, there's quite a substantial evolution expected in the number of massive objects. Now, it does depend on the precise formulation of the dark matter model, and this is shown by Guinevere in one of her conference proceedings, which shows that in a high-density case, you would expect quite a large decline in the volume density of massive ellipticals out to redshifts of 1. Under CDM, it's actually fairly modest. So before the observers go hunting for this evolution, it's pretty important, therefore, that we try to understand the possibilities. Actually, and Simon pointed this out to me, there's some discrepancy that I haven't been able to get to the bottom of between the various predictions, even in the same cosmological model. And I don't know whether anybody has an answer to this. This is the Durham group's stellar mass history in elliptical or spheroidal galaxies and in disks. And this is really useful for the observer, because this is basically telling us, for a specific model, in this case lambda CDM, the kind of evolution we would expect. So let's just go back to Guinevere's plot. So here's 10 to the 11 solar masses. Here's a redshift of 1, and you can see in lambda CDM quite a substantial decline by a redshift of 1. So here's today, so the mass distribution today, redshift 0.5, redshift 1, redshift 2. So you can see by a redshift of 2, total elimination of 10 to the 11 solar mass spheroids. Okay. This isn't even published, so I presume this is the new one, right? here's Guinevere. Here's a redshift of 2, factor of 3. Yeah. So, nice to understand that, but fortunately. Fortunately, it's so different from the classical picture that the observers have something to go on anyway, and that is... Okay, the classical picture, just to remind you, it's still in the textbooks, is that an elliptical galaxy is dense because you're seeing it as it was, as the universe was at the time that it formed, because the collapse is very, very small, there's very little angular momentum, so basically slowly rotating dense objects, little dissipation, formed at early times. So we're here as we go back in this very nice sandage picture of how galaxies form according to various, how the Hubble sequence formed according to the range of dissipation at different times. The spheroidal objects are the oldest objects. So you'd think, therefore, that this is one of the easiest tests. After all, Hubble Space Telescope can resolve kiloparsec scales at any redshift in any cosmology, so surely we should be able to solve that problem and tell the difference between ellipticals that exist out to redshifts of 5 and ellipticals that disappear completely by a redshift of 2. Well, the short answer is that we're working on it, and it's still pretty tough for reasons that I'll explain. So let me now turn to Well, the difference between car. Yeah, okay.
I think that the physical function and the mass function would be slightly different because by changing the electrical signal, you might be getting more of the same
plots. I'm assuming that these plots are field, you know, just, you know, as you know, moving into the field is what we're doing. So, oh, okay. 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 So let's try to understand why then, you know, generally we've moved in the direction of hierarchical formation from the observational point of view. And let's see if we can be fairly critical, see whether any possible exits is, you know, in other words, is the Sandage high redshift initial collapse at early times model completely excluded. So the tightest constraint, I think, is one that's been emerging. It's not attributable to any particular group, I think. It comes from perception for a long time that the infrared light of a galaxy is a much more robust estimate of its assembled stellar mass than the blue light. And so if we could do K-band redshift surveys, we would be more sensitive to the true mass of a galaxy than if we did a survey in the blue. And that's shown in this plot, which I think is the nicest description of this by Guinevere and Stefan. And this is not an evolutionary track. This is basically the apparent brightness in the K-band of a 10 to the 11 solar mass galaxy at the redshift at which it's observed, depending on the history that got it to that particular point in time in terms of its star formation history. And what you see is that if it assembled stars constantly up to that point, or whether it formed them at very early times in one single burst, say at a redshift of infinity, doesn't really change the K magnitude of the galaxy that's then seen at that time. And just to make the point that would not be the case in the optical, what's plotted below is the color, B minus K color, for those same stellar histories. And you can see that there's a huge range. An object that formed at very early times would obviously be very red. And so the blue light, the rest frame blue light of an object would be, the observed B color would therefore be a very, very poor, would scatter all over the place compared to the K light. So if we can do a K redshift survey out to faint limits, then we can test whether there are any massive galaxies. So here's a redshift of 1. This is K magnitude against redshift from the first Keck survey by Cowie and collaborators. And there is some incompleteness up here, but the bottom line is that there's no substantial tail in the redshift distribution, such as would be expected if the numbers served out to some very high redshift. Okay, now let me just say that there's a photometric redshift version of this. If you believe photometric redshifts, then you can go a little bit fainter. This is actually one of the better samples because it has a very large number of bands, including infrared bands, obviously. And again, one sees a shortfall in the number of galaxies beyond a redshift of 1 in photometric redshift space compared to what one would expect if the entire population locally was just in place out to redshifts of out to high redshifts or so. Now, it's possible that there are ways around this. One is, of course, these high redshift objects could be present and obscured. Secondly, it's been suggested that the way in which K magnitudes are measured in the faint data, in terms of aperture effects and surface brightness dimming, may move in the sense of shifting them to fainter K limits. And so if we could spectroscopically verify the K21 sample, for example, that I think would be, I think it's feasible to do. Yeah. But I think if we could demonstrate that the form of the distribution was continuous, you know, in other words, if the K redshift plot could be extended to K of 21, it would be possible to test for aperture effects directly. Okay. So this is probably one of the tightest constraints. We don't see K-luminous galaxies beyond a redshift of 1 in large numbers. Less conclusive, I think, a size evolution. If we look in the Hubble Deep Field, we see galaxies are generally have very small sizes. For a long time, people argued about whether this was a selection effect. We're looking just at the star-forming knots in the UV. Joe Silk and his student Richard Burins have looked at the angular sizes, taking nearby galaxies, zooming them out in redshift, and they conclude that even after allowing for that selection effect, these objects are still much smaller. So this is in the sense that we would expect, but let me just say that I think this is a weak argument, because what one's seeing here is only those portions of the galaxy that are necessarily visible. And so it's quite possible that there's, and by the time you get to a redshift of 2 to 3, you really are always in the rest frame optical, even with NICMOS. And so it's possible that there are underlying areas of red light which would not be detected by HST. So if one applies the same tests to local star-forming spirals and galaxies, it's quite conceivable that one would end up with the same kind of result. So it's consistent, but not particularly compelling. Okay, well, one of the areas that I thought...
There's an argument which goes along with that. Actually much bigger, and you're only seeing a little bit of it.
Yeah.
Then there are a lot more of them than there would be in a local body.
Yeah, yeah. I should show the plot, because actually that is a separate point. What Simon is saying is right, and that is that not only is the half-light radius distribution that's observed shifted to smaller angular sizes than the simulated one, which is the low redshift population zoomed out, but the number of objects is very, very much larger than that observed. It depends on apparent magnitude, range, and so forth. So that works in the same general sense. Okay, so what about the ellipticals then? I made a big point at the beginning that the ellipticals are actually one of the cleanest tests, if we can tell the difference between objects that disappear. Well, this has turned out to be extremely difficult because we don't have a good local luminosity function for field ellipticals. We can find ellipticals out to very faint magnitudes with HST. Generally, we can go to 23rd magnitude in archival data. We can go to I of 24 and even fainter in both Hubble Deep Fields. Felipe Menantaro, a student I mentioned, has measured infrared magnitudes for them. And there's about 300, I think. And he finds that the color distribution in I minus HK, this is a fat infrared filter that spans the H and short K bands, he finds that the color distribution is somewhat shifted to bluer colors than would be the case in the sort of sandage type picture. As you can see, it's not a very significant result, but it's suggestive. Depends. These are, okay, this is a field sample selected down to I of 23. Okay, so I'll concentrate on one panel here, perhaps. So this is purely an apparent magnitude limited sample, no redshift data, and this is a prediction of what we would expect to see to this apparent magnitude limit in color in a classical picture. And as you can see, it depends on metallicity, but generally there's a short, one would expect a much stronger red tail to the distribution than we actually see. And the distribution is indeed shifted bluer. There's some evidence that the number is less, but as I said, the uncertainty in the absolute numbers of field ellipticals is surprisingly large. Yeah, Yeah, so it's not a particular, I'm not saying that this is a particularly good result, and this is This is a very simple prediction. Okay, we're coming to redshifts in a minute. Okay, this is a very simple prediction because this is just instead of. I mean, there's two things you can do. The first thing is count the number of field ellipticals to I of 23. Okay, I've skipped that bit. That was the medium deep survey. And they found that, you know, it depended on the local luminosity function of field ellipticals whether or not there was a decline or not, and the normalization and so forth. This is the next step, which is, are they red? Okay, and okay, so how red should they, would they expect to be at this apparent magnitude? Well, that integrates over a range in redshift, okay? And you're right, that in principle... Well, that's what we're trying to test, right? Okay, so the reason this has not turned out to be as powerful a test as we thought is that it only requires a very small amount of star formation to shift a sandage-like primordial elliptical from here right over here. So it could exist and be massive, and you just trickle a little bit of star formation, and it shifts, you know, to bluer colors. So color, sadly, is not really very powerful. So what we've started looking at now is we've gone back to the Hubble Deep Field, and what we've found is that, and this was quite a surprise, that many of the ellipticals in the Hubble Deep Field have blue cores. So here's a, let me explain what's being plotted here. This is the resolved image in color, so this is V minus I, and here's the color scale from 1.6 to 2.2. So this is a resolved elliptical at a redshift of about 0.6 in the Hubble Deep Field. On the right-hand side is the color per pixel for each, you know, WIFPIC pixel as a function of its surface brightness in I. So you can see it's a remarkably well-behaved object. All internally, this object is remarkably homogeneous. All of the pixels that make it up, from the brightest one in the center to the faintest ones for which the noise is acceptable, have the same color. Here's half an arc second. This is a very different kind of object. Now, you may say, oh, well, I don't think that's an elliptical. But if you looked at that in one monochromatic band, and that's how we classify the objects, this is as sound an elliptical as this object. But it has, you can see it has a blue core. Here's the color range. So this is quite a big change. Here's half a magnitude in color. So this central region here is actually very blue. Now, one of the questions is how many of the field ellipticals are like this and how many are like that? Well, it turns out there's a lot of them that have internal color structure. Now, at some level, some of these objects may be S0s, like this object, for instance. But the striking thing is that about 25% of both Hubble Deep Field samples, south and north, that are classified as ellipticals, show this kind of internal color structure. So they've been classified by me, by I, and by the Abraham concentration asymmetry index. Not so. Well, I'll come to the redshift dependence of this in a second. But you're right. But not so. Not such a large fraction of objects. But they go the other direction. No, opposite sense. They're all, you know, it varies, but basically, you know, that's 2/10. So that's about 2/10 in V minus I. Well, as you can see, they're not all nuclear regions. This thing which we affectionately call the telephone dial is. Yeah. This was the Subaru image, was it, or the right? That was integrated color from memory. Right. Okay. Well, let me tell you what I think's going on, and then you can tell me whether it's consistent with Arimoto. Where are we? Okay, so, yeah, well, actually this doesn't summarize it. Okay, strong differences in internal colors, right. So 25% of field ellipticals have these blue internal structures, and it's very tempting to say that this is recently arrived material. So if there's, you know, if we're looking at the late stage of a merger, or an object with younger stellar populations arriving there, this may be a measure of the amount of mass that's recently arrived on those ellipticals. So when we first saw this result, we thought this is going to be really interesting, because we can take a slice in redshift space and figure out very roughly how much mass has been arriving on these objects. So here's redshift. So if you go to a certain range in redshift and assemble, you know, 20 or 30 of these things, and then try to estimate how much blue light is implied in the population as a whole, and then try to estimate how long ago that blue light arrived, either from spectra or other means, then it would give you the mass arrival rate on a population of ellipticals. If hierarchical pictures were correct, as many people, Guinevere and others, pointed out, you would expect it to be strongly dependent on the environment. If the in the hierarchical picture, one would expect the dense regions to be accelerated, all of this kind of merging activity would have happened at higher redshift, and so one would expect, at a given luminosity, that the inhomogeneity, the internal inhomogeneity in these ellipticals would be much less in the cluster samples than in the field. So Felipe looked at that, and he had a hard time, because the Hubble Deep Field is amazingly good data. And so he scanned around for cluster data that was as good as the Hubble Deep Field data. And he partially succeeded, but only partially. And most of this data comes from the MORFS cluster sample, and also the Dutch equivalent, the Van Dokkum Franks scan rooms, to make sure there's no collaborator here from that group, but I don't think there is. Anyway, there's excellent data, so... Pardon? Oh, okay, right. It was... Oh, that's true. Oh, it's great data! So anyway, what you see is that at low redshift, intermediate redshift, and high redshift, this requires some explanation. This is the degree, you just have to imagine, you know, knottiness or inhomogeneity plotted up here. So this is like the color scatter. We had a huge argument whether to weight it or not, according to the, you know, the intensity of the central pixel and so forth, but against luminosity. So these are the feeble objects, these are the luminous objects, and the green are the field galaxies, the black are the cluster galaxies, and you can see the samples are not small, are not very large, but there's an offset. Cluster ellipticals in these samples, as viewed by Hubble, are more homogeneous, show very little internal color structure, than field ellipticals. And as you get to higher redshift, maybe things start to, you know, come together a little bit. So at the highest redshift in the Van Dokkum data, which is great data, the internal colors start to show some structure. And as you may know, having read his paper, he also believes that at those redshifts, a lot of exciting things are happening. Red objects are coming together and merging and so forth, and I'm not going to talk about that. So this is quite interesting. And the bottom line, I think, from that is that we're seeing for the first time strong differences in intermediate redshifts between the structures of field ellipticals and, as far as we can make the same experiment, cluster ellipticals. Right, so let me now... Well, I was going to say, I'm sort of about... Yeah, let me try to speed up a little bit. All right, okay. Coming to that, yeah, okay. Right, so the last sort of pillar of verifying the hierarchical picture from observational point of view is the merger rate, and there's some contradictions here, and I don't think we're home and dry on this one. And so one of the most amazing things about the Hubble data was when we first started seeing these medium deep survey pictures, we started seeing lots of galaxies at bright magnitudes that had irregular morphologies. Of course, there are irregular galaxies today, but when we predicted how many with simple K corrections that we ought to see, it fell short by large factors. Now, for many years, people rightly pointed out that if you look at familiar-looking objects at short wavelengths, they start to appear knotty and irregular, and there were a number of papers that tried to explain this rise in the number of irregular galaxies with redshift, with apparent magnitude, as a selection effect. And although we did copious simulations to prove this wasn't the case, in the end it required data, I think, to silence everybody. It's usually the case. And that's from the very nice NICMOS images of the Hubble Deep Field taken by Mark Dickinson. And this is just one example. This is a galaxy at a redshift of 1.3 in Hubble Deep Field North. That looks irregular at all wavelengths, including the longest one that HST can currently image. And you'll have to take my word for it, looking, he hasn't published the full sample yet, but if you look at his pictures, those of you who've seen them will know that this is not an isolated example. Most of the irregular objects in the Hubble Deep Field look irregular at all wavelengths. So how do we estimate then the merging, whether these objects merge into regular galaxies? Well, firstly, just to say, an awful lot of light is in these irregular objects. This is from Jarle-Brinchmann's thesis, and this is a best efforts basis at the luminosity density as a function of redshift for different morphologies. So this is like the sort of star formation plots that I showed you earlier in terms of luminosity density, but broken into ellipticals, not much change, spirals, some decline, but the biggest gradient is in these irregular objects, which this is in B, luminosity density in B. So these are all from CFRS. So this is CFRS isolated, and then the morphologies added. And the reason why it's a best efforts is that he's attempted to correct for objects below the CFRS magnitude limit. So there's a huge demise in this population in terms of starlight. And so where do they go? Well, at least three papers on the merger rate. One of the first was Patton et al., the CNOC sample. And so what they did is they went to the CNOC redshift survey, found close pairs, and estimated a rise in the number, in the fraction of objects that appeared to be merging simply from their proximity in projected space. Olivier Lefebvre did the same thing with the HST data that I've just told you. So basically, galaxies classed as pairs. And the trends between these two samples, basically very similar methods, do agree reasonably well. So this is not the merger rate, this is the fraction of galaxies in these samples that are, after correcting for foreground and background projection from the surface density of these objects, plotted against 1 plus redshift, that the fraction of objects apparently merging goes with redshift as 1 plus redshift to the 3 or so. Now, you can't, unfortunately, that's about as far as you can get, because it's very difficult to convert that into a mass rate or a merger rate, because you've no idea of the timescales involved in these activities. But let me just comment on an apparent contradictory result that's just come on the web from Carlberg and Judy Cohen and others. And they combined the CNOT redshift survey with the Caltech faint redshift survey from Judy Cohen's work with low res, and looked at the pair fraction in dynamical space. Now, the previous samples I showed you were just projected pairs without any redshift information. And what Ray has calculated here is he's taken the redshift samples and looked at objects which fall within their selection criteria, so there's a magnitude-limited sample in both cases, within a fixed projected radius and within a certain dynamical difference between the pairs. And what you see is a very slow redshift dependence. And I think this is basically because of the way in which this, I don't think this disagrees with the previous result, but it illustrates the difficulty. Let me explain. Pardon? I'm about to tell you. The sentence began. Okay. These, by definition, because this is a magnitude limited sample, of two samples, one sort of petering out about here, the other petering out about here, basically they choose objects that are going to be equal in luminosity. Okay? Whereas in the previous sample, the technique that was done was an object with a known redshift was selected, and then a much fainter magnitude limit was applied, and the satellites around that object were counted. Okay? So the combination of these two techniques, if one can imagine doing this really well, in the K-band, for example, would be quite powerful. If you could, at each redshift, get a sample of how many luminous objects are nearby, how many fainter objects, and so on. But until then, all this is indicating is that there's some evidence that the number of merging pairs is increasing with redshift, and it depends very sensitively on the luminosities of the objects. Let me just say that Carlberg estimated from this that we're talking about 15% of M star arriving on a program galaxy, whatever that may be, in this sample since a redshift of 1. So it's not a great... Yeah, that's only down to about L star or so. There's a lot of interesting remarks in that. I have to be careful what I say. There's a lot of interesting remarks in that paper about, you know, the generality of this expression. So, for example, if M was low, you know, then, you know, it would have a huge effect on a low mass galaxy. But it's not obvious that what is observed here can be applied generally. So that's really where we've got to. So you can see there are indications of hierarchical assembly, but they're not really, in any case, completely self-consistent yet. I think the K-band light is a very powerful technique. One has to struggle quite hard to get out of it. Size evolution is indicative, but not particularly profound. The field ellipticals has turned out to be more complicated than we thought, but perhaps the most exciting result there is these blue cores in the field samples. And the merger rate turns out to be really quite a difficult thing to get at. So I think this is all heading in the right direction. But yeah. Right. Yeah.
So back from redshift 3 to redshift near 1 in a path evolution model, different type of evolution. So if you corrected the luminosity density, what you said the stellar density would be as a, in a path evolution model, where you've got fewer stars at the high redshift and below redshift.
You mean you would have expected this to have risen more? Is that? Yeah.
It's quite strong.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. Look at the error bars. This is 300 galaxies, so, you know. There are, yeah. That's the error bar.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, gosh. I have to check, I can't remember. probably different ways of correcting for incompleteness. I think that these error bars are statistical, and I think the differences between the different symbols represent different ways of... Yeah, or something like that. If you have to worry about the error bars, it's not a very good result. Okay, so... What did I say? Oh, God! Okay, so the next part of the talk is to try to move forward from, you know, to try to get a more robust way of getting the masses. And this is work right at the beginning, but it's going to give you an idea of where we might go. So let's first look at dynamics. So you've probably read Nicole Vogt's papers. So the idea here is that we, or she, because she's really basically the person leading this effort, look at the resolved rotation curves of HST-selected galaxies at different redshifts. And this is extremely impressive work in that you can see the dynamical form of the rotation curve for an individual object, in this case at a redshift of 0.6, and this is 200 kilometers per second. So the challenge with this work is, firstly, it's extremely difficult. It's only possible in favorable cases. In other words, she selects objects that are have favorable inclinations. She ideally would like emission lines. She's looking at regular objects. And the conclusion that she comes to is that there's not much evolution in the Tully-Fisher relation out to moderate redshift. At least last time I spoke to her, that's what she was saying. And without detracting from the achievement, one worries that this is in some sense inbuilt to selecting regular, mature, favorable objects for study. One would like a technique that complements this, that looks at all galaxies, if possible. And that may not be possible, but that's the restriction at the moment with that approach. Very recently, you've seen probably on the web the preprints from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, where they've selected from their photometric data a slice of background galaxies and a slice of foreground galaxies, and looked at the statistical signal of distortion of a background galaxy with respect to a foreground galaxy from gravitational lensing by the foreground galaxy. In an individual case, it's extremely weak signal. Averaged over very large samples, they have a pretty good detection, I think. Can this be used to measure the masses of galaxies? It can. The problem is that, in principle, you can break it up into different classes of galaxies and so forth. The problem is, as a way of probing the evolution of galaxies, it's maybe not going to be very powerful because lensing, by its nature, can't be applied to an object at a given redshift very easily. One has to really have well-defined samples of background and foreground galaxies, and lockstep going out in redshift turns out to be very difficult with gravitational lensing, simply because of the way in which angular diameter distance changes with redshift. So I suspect this is a fascinating result, but it's not going to become the main tool for measuring the masses of galaxies of different morphologies at different redshifts. But maybe with NGST, I'll be wrong, and by then that will be one of the most interesting ways forward. Accretion, okay, so let me go back to this thing and explain what we're trying to do at the moment. So if this object has a blue core here because of recent star formation, then if we could get in very good conditions the spectrum of that part of the galaxy, then it may be that we can quantify how long or how recently those stellar populations were formed, or the most recent activity. And that's conventionally done. It's been done in cluster samples with some success. The Butcher-Omler effect showed spectra of this kind, and that the modeling of those spectra has been used by many people, Poggianti, for example, to quantify how much material recently arrived on cluster ellipticals. In this case, what we would like to do is to be able to use the Bartholine spectra of these kind of objects and compare them with control objects that don't have these blue cores to see whether we can make progress in estimating the amount of stellar mass that's involved in these blue cores. So, well, you can make a stab. I think basically what you could do is determine whether this is, perhaps let me just show you one plot which tells you roughly the amount of blue light that would be needed. Sorry, the amount of mass that would be needed to create this blue light. So this is a rather complicated plot, but it's basically that same color in homogeneity, okay, against redshift. And so zero would be a homogeneous elliptical following some passive track. And then if one threw in 15% of the amount of, if one threw in 15% of young material over some timescale, then it gives you the kind of excursion that we would expect to see. So models like this can in principle predict the spectral appearance. Now, if you think about it, if this is an ongoing process, then with a large sample, we should be able to determine how many we would expect to see in different stages. So it's not as, you know, the spectra alone are only one part of the story. So I think there's some promise in this, but I wasn't going to sell it particularly right now, because it's really only applies in this restricted case of these well-defined regular ellipticals. And one of the problems with the whole business of galaxy evolution in this redshift range 2 to 0 is that objects may be wandering into this class from somewhere else, wandering out again, and what we really would like is some accounting method that tracks objects wherever they go in morphology so that we can see how many are coming in and going out at different redshifts. And that's really what I want to spend the remainder of the talk on. I've run out of time, actually. Is that and that is, let's go back to this question of the infrared luminosity. So here are the papers that have proposed infrared light as a probe of stellar mass. Now remember I showed you Guinevere's plot, which was that the color was very sensitive to the star formation history, but the K magnitude was not. And so to first order, K was telling you the stellar mass. And what Yala did for his thesis is really quite simple, and that is he said, well, why not use the color data to make a minor correction to try to get an improved estimate? And so what he's using is not only the K luminosity, but also the color to try to eliminate the discrepancy or the differences between those different star formation histories. And you don't have to do it very precisely, but it makes, as you'll see, it makes a slightly refined estimate. And it's in very much the same way as the photometric redshifts. In the case of the photometric redshifts, you have the pass bands, but you don't know the redshift, so you take the Bruswell models and fit the SEDs to the data. In this case, we have the redshift. We simply want to know what's the range of star formation history that got the galaxy to its particular color distribution. And there's obviously some degeneracy in that, and he looked at that by various likelihood techniques. And this just shows the likelihood fits for the stellar mass on a log scale. Here's a factor of 2. And you can see that there are some cases where the colors are exactly like in photometric redshifts. In some cases it doesn't work very well, in some cases it works extremely well. So the bottom line is that here is a statistical method that takes the K light, takes the colors, and tries to fit the stellar mass that's consistent with those data sets. Now, it just turned out by fortune that there was an overlap with Nicole's sample of spirals. Not a great overlap, only a few objects, but we were then able to plot the stellar mass against her dynamical mass. And that's shown here, and this is the ratio. And what you see here is the corrected ratio for the for various galaxies in common, and this is a factor of 10 offset. So in other words, this is a system, this line corresponds to a system with a dynamical mass that's 10 times greater than the stellar mass. So this is the kind of, these of course are mostly vote spirals, so this kind of offset of a factor of 10 or so is pretty consistent with what we know about spirals locally, for example. It's from her... we measured the disk size for her objects as well. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Because they all have HST data. Okay, so let's just explore this then. So let's now look at... let's look at how stellar mass assembles itself. Okay. And the idea here is we've got a large sample of galaxies, about 400, I think, 450. Doesn't say. Oh. I think it's about 400, for which we have infrared colors, optical colors, redshifts, and morphologies. And the idea here is that, in principle, we can start creating plots like this. Now, at the moment, they look very noisy, so I'm only going to show it for a few seconds. But this is a stellar mass density. Okay, so instead of a luminosity function, okay, we now have a stellar mass function against log mass. And here are the ellipticals at different redshifts. Redshifts are blue, high redshifts are blue, intermediate redshifts are green. Here are the spirals, and here are the peculiars. And the data are too, it's clear, the data are too noisy yet at the moment to have proper confidence in the shapes of the distributions and the trends. And there's another problem that will, I think, be eliminated in due course, and that is that these are optically selected samples for which K light is being used, modulo or minor correction, to get the stellar mass. So there's a deficiency in low mass objects because they'd be too dim to be detected. And that is correlated in a way with age and so forth. This dotted line is the same thing derived from the Loveday luminosity function, okay, locally. So this is a K-selected sample of which there are redshifts. And one of the problems then is, in the absence of a K-selected HST sample, how do we correct for that? And let me say that at the moment, it's not obvious how best to do that, but if one integrates over all luminosities, one gets an interesting plot, and that is that this is then the equivalent of that previous plot. Remember, I showed you a plot which had the luminosity density of irregulars declining, and the ellipticals slightly rising, and the spirals declining. This is the same thing in stellar mass. Okay, so this is the integral of those plots corrected as best we can. I've got the raw one up here. It doesn't make a big deal of difference, but you can see that the irregulars are declining in their stellar mass density as well. Now that's quite an important result, because although one can switch off star formation in blue light, which is what the previous plot showed you, in stellar mass you can't destroy these objects. So this mass that's declining per unit volume in irregulars has to go somewhere. Other than the only other way out would be to sort of blow apart the galaxies and have. Yes, yeah, that's right. And so it's, well, the most reassuring aspect of this is the sum is constant. And so what this is implying, at least to first order at the moment, is that this decline in the stellar mass density of peculiars is at the expense of a slight increase in the regular objects.
Wait, sorry, did you force that constant?
No. No, that comes out. No, this is saying that the stellar mass that we see in these peculiar objects, okay, per unit volume is declining. No. This is saying This is saying that the amount of stellar mass in these objects, you know, is declining. Pardon? The black line. Oh, this. You want the sum to go up? Oh, right. You want this to rise? Why? Because stars are still forming. This is the contribution, though.
In other words, there should be more actual numbers of stars.
Well, look at the uncorrected one. Are you happy with the uncorrected? Are you happier? You're happier with the uncorrected one. Right. Okay. Right. So let me move to the spirals then. Let me summarize this way. Maybe this is clearer. At high redshift, a substantial fraction of the peculiars have high stellar masses. Okay. If you look at the peculiar galaxies today, most of them have are relatively low mass objects. You remember that the luminosity function I showed you at the beginning was really quite steep. And the real issue is how those objects get destroyed. So if you have a lot of mass in irregular objects, so they're luminous in K, I mean that's the bottom line here, then those objects have to transform themselves into something that forces them not to be peculiar at intermediate and lower redshift. And so that's the main result that I think that comes out of this survey at the moment. Well, it depends whether the numbers are conserved. If the objects fall into other objects, of course. Yeah. Right, but that's, you know, I mean, what we're trying to head for is to try to understand, for example, whether let's make one connection that might be worth exploring. Supposing the blue knots in the ellipticals, you know, were primarily coming from these peculiar galaxies assembling into, you know, spheroidal products. Okay, that's a kind of connection that may pretty soon be possible with a larger sample. We'll be able to look at the amount of mass that's being assembled in elliptical galaxies and then look at the gradient of this kind of plot, wherever it's gone, okay, to see the rate at which it's disappearing. Now, the main point I want to make is that it's not possible to do this with any other technique other than an all-embracing method that covers the stellar mass of all objects.
Wow.
Well, look, yeah, in principle, yes. You know,
total mass today,
yeah.
More than 10 to 11 solar masses. So
Yeah.
You can already say that those things that are a fraction of that work is done. Because you look at them, you already can get the kettle out, so it's the lower limit on it.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Look, you know, just look at the error bars. You should be sitting here, I think. Okay, I really should wrap up because this is going on forever. But let me just finish with something about spirals, because I know discs are of interest to many theorists at the moment. Basically, what can we say about the history of spiral structure? And let me make a few remarks about that. Firstly, look at this picture. It's beautiful. This is a grand design spiral in the Hubble Deep Field at a redshift of 1. And you see part of the problem of galaxy classification here. It's got a bar in the infrared. It's not obvious it has a bar in the optical, but nobody would dispute that this is a well-formed object. If one looks at the numbers of spirals as a function of redshift for a magnitude-limited sample, that's shown here. So this is the CFRS LDSS survey again. This is number against redshift. And this is what you would expect from the present luminosity function. Okay, so you take the present day spiral luminosity function, predict how many you would expect to see to I of 22.5, and that's what you get. So there's no shortage of spirals. In fact, there's an excess. And that excess is almost certainly because they were brighter in the past. We know that because we can measure their surface brightnesses. That was a no evolution prediction, and just for completeness, this is a Mickey Mouse evolutionary model that just makes them brighter by 1 magnitude at a redshift of 1 linearly. Okay, so that's the. So we're talking about a magnitude change in their luminosity in rest frame B by a redshift of 1. To first order be consistent with that data. Simon Lilly with us on the CFRS LDSS sample, using David Shade's code to measure the exponential scale length and surface brightness of the disks in the spirals in our sample. This is a tricky thing to do, of course, because not all of them are well sampled, so there are good spirals and poor spirals in here, different symbols. This is the Freeman distribution from the sample of from the local sample of De Jong. So this is central surface brightness against redshift. Unfortunately, there's a selection effect. You can't see small disks at high redshift in a magnitude limited sample. So you have to be a little bit careful. occasionally a poor fit gets you down there, but we'll ignore that. Bottom line is that there's some evidence for this brightening in the distribution. It's really tentative, but it's in the sense that that would be needed to account for that redshift distribution. So again, spirals, no evidence for a decline in disks in their numbers, and the photometric data consistent with increased star formation activity. That, remember, is consistent with those plots of the luminosity density. Well, you mean, yeah, this is the mean, so it's not great. It's not a great result. But it's in the direction that is needed to explain the redshift distribution. Oh well, okay. Well, you know, then you're in real trouble. If you don't like that result, then you know, then spirals are being destroyed. I was just about to come to that. Doesn't make sense, as Simon knows, I think, although he probably has an explanation. No change. Okay, so no change in the offset. So this is Tully Fisher. This is. Is this paper out now? The last K Keck sample. Okay. Well, I got this from Dave Coos, one of Dave Coos' conference proceedings, but last summer. So this, pardon? But this, yeah, okay, so this was 1999. So this is the local data. This is the fit. So, well, sorry, the red dotted line is the local data. The central yellow line is, the red line is the fit to the data. The central yellow line is the local relation. And they're not offset at all. So, pardon?
No evolution.
No evolution. Pretty worrying. Maybe. What do you think?
Well, it's fun. He was starting to do
it. Okay, let me finish with bulges, because I never get to bulges. Bulges and bars. Bulges. Bulges, there's more to say about bulges than bars at the moment. Okay, so, what? No, I have less to say about bars than bulges. Okay. Okay, well, that's, why don't we discuss that when I finish, because I've only got a couple of minutes. So, bulges. Okay, remember Sandage's plot, bulges are primordial. In the hierarchical picture, at least as propounded from Durham, these bulges should generally be older than elliptical. So here's a prediction from Carlton Bohr. This is the color distribution of a bulge compared, so the bulges are the blue points, the ellipticals are the red points, and at low redshift there's not much difference because most of the ellipticals have then been assembled, but by the time you get to a redshift of one or so, then in order to form an elliptical, you have to form a disk. You have to merge two, in this very simple picture, you have to form two disks, merge them together to form an elliptical. And so basically, not only is there number evolution, but also in the semi-analytic code, they can calculate at the time that they recognize an elliptical, how it compares to a bulge. So this is clearly, you could play around with this definition of when an object becomes a recognizable elliptical. But the bottom line is that generally the stellar populations in bulges should have ended their activity at earlier times than those in ellipticals, at least in this picture. So can we test that? Well, what we did was we waited until Hubble Deep Field South was available. This is probably not going to work. And we chose... There are 76 face-on-like or conveniently oriented spirals in both Hubble Deep Fields. In Hubble Deep Field North, they nearly all have redshifts. Magnitude limit is I/24. In Hubble Deep Field South, most of them only have photometric redshifts. What we've set out to try to do, it's pretty ambitious, is to measure the color of the bulge. How do we do that? Well, remember I showed you the pixel-by-pixel method. And what we decided to do was to go to each object in turn and to take a radius that's a proportion of the isofodal radius and then to look at the colors of the pixels within that radius. So here's a spiral. I can't remember the redshift. Oh, 0.1, so that's a low redshift spiral. Here's one at 0.3. This is one at a redshift of 1. So these cover quite a range in redshift. And for each little ring, I've plotted the color of the pixels contained within that ring. So what you can see is that the central part of this galaxy, the inner 2% in radius, is very, very red. It's the reddest part in B minus V, and it's pretty well the reddest part in V minus I. And as one goes to larger radii, the photometric errors get slightly larger, and there's a little bit more distribution. But almost in every case, you can see that the bulge is, or the central part of the galaxy, is always the reddest part of the spiral. And if we compare these colors with the colors of the equivalent done for ellipticals, and here's an elliptical at a redshift of 1, so here's its color, and you can see it's very homogeneous. These are just photometric errors in B minus V. So this particular object is quite homogeneous. And what we found is really quite surprising. This is color against redshift. The black objects are the central regions of the ellipticals. So you can see here are those ellipticals with blue cores. And the bulges generally, although, let me emphasize, they are the reddest parts of the spirals in nearly every case, as the intrinsic colors of those bulges are much bluer than the ellipticals.
Right.
Okay, well, here's a data set worth predicting. I mean, I would say there's two things about this plot that are important. One is that clearly bulges, as best we can identify them, and obviously there's some uncertainty about how we can do that, bulges as a population do not share the properties of elliptical galaxies at intermediate redshift. It would be really nice to have a good sample of low redshift objects for which the same test could be carried out. The second point is perhaps a more profound one, and that's there's a dispersion, there's a big dispersion in the colors of bulges. And that's, to me, that kind of dispersion seems to imply, you know, continuing arrival of young stars. I mean, that's probably the simplest way to explain this. Right. Well, yeah. Okay. Well, we went out to I think it was 5%. Discontamination. Okay. Well, we did. Obviously, we thought about discontamination, and there are two things we did. One is we looked at the trend as a function of, for example, the size of the disk, the inclination of the disk. You know, in well presented cases like this one, for example, or this one. And secondly, we simulated. We took, again, the Young sample, and we took his objects, we placed them at various redshifts, and we applied this 5% criterion and the 2 and 7% criterion, and probably somewhere I have that plot. Gives you an indication of the way in which he estimates his colors by a fitting technique. Obviously, I should stop. And that's the kind of uncertainty that we would expect. We can take his objects, place it at a redshift of 0.7, and simulate our U minus V. And at a redshift of 0.4, our colors simulate B minus R. So we're talking about uncertainties in the color between various ways of estimating them for simulated De Jong objects of about plus or minus 0.2. Okay, so, you know, it's tough. But, you know, that's the kind of uncertainty, kind of systematic uncertainty. So, you know, it's not going to be, it's not going to get any better than that, probably.
I think we have Scott Kelly again, who's saying there was a, well, he looked at indices with both separate age and
ellipticity in low redshift. Right.
And he claimed that there was dichotomy between big bulges and small bulges.
Right.
Big bulges were as old as ellipticals.
And older than the disk.
And older than the disk.
Small bulges are the same age.
There's nothing here. Well, okay.
It was up to the profile. So the Debalcour bulges were the ones that were lighter.
Right.
And the exponential bulges. Can you look at the profile?
No.
Are
Yeah, that was on that plot. Yeah, exactly. It's about 15% of the stellar mass of the bulge, so it's not a large amount. Depends how quickly you... Right. But the variation that you see must imply that it's a very frequent phenomenon. Okay, it's not, you know, just an odd object. It's actually... Well, let's just go through that. Let me understand. Obviously, it's easier for us to pick out the massive bulges in the distant galaxies, and so most of the objects in this sample of 76 are objects where the bulge is recognizable, and so therefore, you know, a healthy bulge. So go through. Right. Let me make a point that may distinguish between what he's doing. What we're doing is we're not comparing disks with bulges. I showed you that the bulges were always redder than the disks. Okay. What we're comparing is the bulge with a passively evolving elliptical track. Okay. So this track here. Okay, is, you know, your favorite high redshift elliptical formed at a redshift of 3 or 5, and then the passive evolution of that object. So the k-correction track runs pretty well through these points, maybe a little bit higher, but not much. These objects are being compared with well-defined old stellar populations, and they're bluer. Now, I'm not making any statement about the relationship between the bulges and the disks, or luminosities of the individual bulges. I'm just saying that bulges appear to have had a more interesting star formation history than many field ellipticals at a given redshift. That's all. And that's, you know, the opposite of what Carlton and Carlos and so have been saying. And on that note... Well, here's redshift. Shall I finish there with some conclusions? Okay, so the main thing is let's try and, you know, the main challenge for the observers is let's try now and go and start looking at the mass assembly. Let's look at the structure of the individual galaxies. Let's try and identify how much mass is in the various components, and let's see if we can find a way of doing an accounting test that tells us where mass is going in different redshift ranges. And I think that's there are various methods that allow us to get towards that goal. So far as we have conclusions from what we've done so far, I would say that there's pretty good evidence that field ellipticals are forming continuously, maybe from high redshift irregulars. The evolution of spiral disks is pretty slow. And bulges are not the passively evolving objects that some people think they are. So I'll stop there. That's actually a very good idea. Yeah. We thought for a long time of clever way. Yeah, I agree. I'm always reminded by Mark Dickinson that the HDF is a pathetically small sample. I've forgotten how many L star galaxies should we have expected to see in it? It was some hand. Yeah, but this is a sample out to redshift of about 1. So, but you know, that's. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, well, that's a good idea.
how complete is the plot, star formation versus red shift in terms of galaxy mass? Is there any strength in the, could you hide anything in those dark five without this, for example? And if yes, how much? For example, if you assume that every GM halo has a constant mass to mass ratio, how much more light could you?
Well, I didn't talk about that, and the low surface brightness people have... Right. Okay, well, two things. I showed you at the very beginning that there's a lot of objects that are feeble at all redshift. So if you take star-forming objects, there are I know of three samples, a Stiedel photometrically selected Lyman break sample, which has been extended to, you know, some ludicrous magnitude, U of 27 or something, and they see a very steep luminosity function. If you go to the Chuck now has a sample at a redshift of 1, which is Balmer selected, that has a very steep luminosity function also. And I showed you the UV sample at low redshift, which has an alpha of minus 1.55. So the first answer is there's an awful lot of energy in feeble little things, and it seems to be a characteristic of star-forming galaxies that this is the case at all the redshifts where we've been able to probe reliably the luminosity function of a very wide range. Okay. Now the second point is there a possibility of these objects disappearing into remnants that are undetected today? And I think the answer to that is no, because that, as we go to the infrared, okay, we would expect to see them. And you can calculate that if these objects didn't appear as regular objects somewhere else, firstly, the infrared counts would have a much steeper rise at very faint infrared limits, and that's been tested now with NICMOS to quite faint limits, and there's no perceptible Euclidean component to the counts that is significant. No, I'm talking about low redshift, right? Yeah. Right. So, yeah. Can I understand what the question is then? Because I'm not sure I'm answering the right question then. So, say the question again. Oh. Well, yeah, at the most fundamental level, probably yes. I'm saying that we're missing objects in many ways. I'm not denying that there's a problem. Okay, we're missing objects wherever we've been able to do a proper experiment. We've been able to see that we could potentially miss star-forming objects. That was the first point I made. Okay, so luminosity function is always steep. Okay, as in star-forming objects. So in any sample, you know, that is magnitude limited, we probably don't get the full story of what's happening. So that's one of the first points I made. As far as low surface brightness galaxies, generally objects which are completely missed in thresholding data and so forth, that's, you know, the low surface brightness people, where they've been able to test that, have indeed found that these objects do exist. But I don't know what Julian D'Alcantin now thinks, but my version of what they're now saying is I think they've climbed down a lot from where they were. In other words, they used to appear at conferences and make huge fuss about this, you know, that 80 or 90% of the universe was in these objects. But where the tests have been done, it's quite clear that the contribution to the stuff and to the contribution to the volume average star formation is actually very modest from these objects. But that
zero redshift from luminosity density from really low surface brightness stuff, probably an additional 10 to 20%.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Is there a high redshift?
Well, we don't know.
We don't know.